I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Bree Pettis, the co-founder of MakerBot Industries, a company that makes three-dimensional printers. So instead of producing ink on paper, the machine makes actual objects made out of plastic. Bree started the company in 2009 with his partners Zach Hokensmith and Adam Mayer. Prior to starting MakerBot, Bree was a public elementary school teacher in Seattle, Washington, a puppeteer, and an artist. He also is one of the founders of NYC Resistor, a hacker collective located in Brooklyn. Bree's also a video podcast producer, TV host, and father. Welcome.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
What is MakerBot?
So a MakerBot is a machine that can make you anything. It's a replicator. So let's say you want something, you can imagine it and design it, or maybe somebody else has made it and you can download it, and then you just print it out. So say you need a bottle opener, you just print one out, and then you're opening bottles.
It's made out of plastic that feels kind of like Legos. What kind of plastic is it?
Well, there's two kinds of plastic you can use in a MakerBot right now, and we're exploring more. We're looking for more things to print with. But you can use ABS or PLA. ABS is a really common plastic. It's what most of the plastic you have in your life is made out of. It's like it's the same thing that Lego's made out of. PLA is another plastic we use, and it's made from corn, and it is biodegradable, and when you make things out of it, it smells like waffles.
3D printers have been around for decades, but they are very expensive and hundreds of thousands of dollars and huge, but your printers cost roughly $1,300. What was the impetus for wanting to create a cheaper 3D printer?
Well, we really wanted one, and they were really expensive, and so we just used the materials we had at hand and the tools we had at hand. We have a laser cutter that we share, and we just kept trying. So we locked ourselves up in our hackerspace with literally two cases of ramen and a lot of Club Mate, which is a caffeinated beverage. And we basically just camped out there making prototype after prototype. And we'd been working all through the night for days.
What was the first object you made with your 3D printer when it finally worked?
Oh, we promptly printed out a shot glass and had drinks.
You promptly printed out a shot glass and then hopped on a plane to South by Southwest, which is a leading technology innovative conference in Austin. What did South by Southwest lead to, if anything, for you?
Well, you know, we had made 20 kits for people to have their own 3D printer. And we thought, okay, we'll sell 10, and then we'll have 10 to sell next month. And then, of course, we sold those, like, really quickly. Like, within 2 weeks, we had sold out of the thing we thought would take 2 months to sell. So the race was on.
Who buys these 3D machines?
You know, the people who buy 3D printers are a real mix, because you've got some, you know, you've got the obvious kind of engineers, hackers, programmer types that get them. And then you've got just ordinary people who live in the future who want to have a machine that can make anything so that when they need something, they don't have to go to the store. They can just print it out and have it.
It takes a little while for you to kind of get your hands around exactly what it is we're talking about. Maybe it's my failure of imagination, but it took me some time to actually understand, okay, well, this is a printer not producing ink, but actually making stuff.
Yeah, it's a replicator. It replicates your ideas into real objects. It makes things, your ideas, real. And, you know, we're used to being consumers. We're used to, you know, if we want a clock, we think, okay, well, where do I go shop for that? Mm-hmm. When you have a MakerBot, the world's different. You see the world through MakerBot glasses. You can actually print out glasses. But when you have a MakerBot, you think, okay, I need a clock. Well, maybe I'll MakerBot one. And in fact, a group of folks actually did collaborate, and they made a grandfather clock mechanism that's just beautiful and ticks and everything.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bree Pettis, the co-founder of MakerBot Industries, a company that makes open-source robots that make plastic objects. You grew up in Ithaca, New York, and then moved to Seattle, Washington. What was your home life like? What did your parents do, for example?
You know, my dad is he's a marketer. His website is brand.com, so he's been doing it for a while. And my mom does a bunch of stuff, including art.
How did you become interested in making things or tinkering? Do you have early experiences of just being very hands-on?
You know, I got into tinkering when I went to go visit my Aunt Meredith, who at that time was married to a guy named Joe. And Joe, his job was every morning he'd wake up and I'd get into his pickup truck with him at like 4 a.m. in Boston. He knew all the trash routes. And we'd go on the trash routes before the trash men came. And we'd pick out all the good stuff. And then during the week, during the day, he would fix that stuff up and on the weekend sell it at a flea market. And that week, we picked up a couple bikes that were broken and put them together. And he made me feel like I knew, like he let me put things together and figure out how it worked so that at the end, it was really my bike. I'd put that bike together, even though I was like 7.
By the way, where does the name Bree come from?
So my name Bree is short for Bree Huspety, and it comes from my parents who were hippies at the time. Their yogi gave me that name.
Your parents were not in the technology field at all, but your grandfather was. He also made machines. What kind of work did he do?
So my grandpa had a company called High Speed Checkware in Ithaca. His company made machines that would weigh things really quickly. So when Morton salt comes down the production line in long lines of circular tubes, his machine would be on the line, and it would quickly weigh things. And if there wasn't enough salt in one of the containers, it would knock it off. So he made machines that would weigh things at a high speed.
When you were growing up in Seattle, you know, Bill Gates, Microsoft was pretty big. Did that have any impact on your, you know, your thinking at all?
You know, Microsoft is something. I had friends whose parents worked at Microsoft, and Bill Gates moved into the neighborhood. And I don't know so much one of the things that did affect me is I had a friend who worked at Nintendo, and Paul Scanlon had a job where his job was to play games all day. He was a tester, and then later on he was a game counselor, because back in those days you could call, if you didn't mind paying long distance, you could call up Nintendo and talk to somebody and be like, I can't get through this level, and they'd be like, go find the magic hammer and hit it this wall with it, mm-hmm, that kind mm-hmm. of thing. And that was his job. And I remember thinking, oh, that's such a, you know, that's a job that somebody does. Like, that exists in the world. Like, mm-hmm. there's not just, like, you're going to be a doctor or a nurse or a farmer or something like this. There's people who play games for a living. Okay, anything can happen.
How much was the notion of you're having to make a living, how large did that loom in your career choices, for example?
For me, in terms of my career, I've always felt really strongly to, you know, follow my heart. I read, you know, the whole Joseph Campbell Power of Myth series and was very inspired to follow my passion. And so you don't go into teaching to make money. I think after 7 years, I was making about $31,000 a year. But I was there because I wanted to create infrastructure for people to make things, to learn how to be creative. And that's been a thread through my whole life, the idea of creating infrastructure for people to be creative and being creative.
You've been a public school teacher, but what was your own education like?
You know, it was mixed. I mean, I dropped out of middle school because I just didn't want to go, and I was having to face bullies and get into fights all the time. So I just dropped out of seventh grade and was happy to do so. And then, you know, later on, I realized, like, okay, school, fine. I see how this works. I have to do this to make other things happen. Basically, I kind of got back into school when I was, like, a sophomore, and I realized, okay, I'll jump through the hoops to make sure I can make something else happen. And then I got lucky, and I ended up going to the Evergreen State College, which is a liberal arts college in Olympia, Washington, where there are no requirements except that you have to have X amount of credits before you can graduate. So you can study anything. I studied everything from political science and history to education and ethnomusicology and mythology and psychology, and ended up doing dance for 2 years and being in a samba band and playing gamelan. And so I was able to just continually explore different kinds of things and try different things out.
You talk about dropping out of school in seventh grade. So you're 12 years old. What does that mean? Like, you wake up in the morning and what do you do?
You know, as a kid, when you go to school and you're the first 6 months of school are full of intimidation and bullying, you just find a way to not go. You just wake up and you think, I'm not going.
Where'd you go? What'd you do?
I just stayed at home and read books.
And what did your parents say?
It didn't matter. I wasn't going.
But what did they say?
I don't remember.
So they didn't have much choice.
No, I wasn't going.
What was the experience like for you of being an elementary school teacher in the public school system in Seattle? Was it creative as you had hoped?
As a teacher, I got to be the art teacher, which is one of the last places you're actually not bound by teaching to the test in American public schools. And so I got to teach kids how to make things, how to sew a button. Most kids don't know how to sew a button if they lose a button. They don't know how to put it back. So there's kind of basic skills like that that are really satisfying and make young people feel really independent. But the bureaucracy and the underfundedness of schools these days means that really there's not enough resources to do to be effective as a teacher and with 32 kids in a classroom. It eventually wears you down. After being a school teacher for 7 years, I can honestly say, like, if you can, drop out of school. If you're somebody who can follow your passion and try things out and develop infrastructure for yourself, if you have that kind of discipline, find other ways to learn things.
So here you are, a frustrated art teacher, and you said, okay, I'm going to move to Brooklyn. Talk to me about that moment.
So there were a couple things that happened. I had come to New York on vacation, and I had seen some video art at an art gallery. And I said, this is neat. I want one. How much is this artwork? And they said, well, the DVD is $15,000. And I had that kind of like Picasso moment of like, yeah, I could do that. Mm-hmm. So I went back and I made a video, and that was an art video called the I Love You Project. And I took it around to galleries in Seattle and I said, here's my video. I'm ready to display it. And they all liked it. But after, a month or two, it had been seen by like 4 people and nothing had happened. So I was like, screw this. I'm putting it on the internet. And sure enough, after like a few months, like 50,000 people had watched it. And I was like, okay, that's more than Phil's Mariners Stadium, But I like this. I like this kind of attention. So I started making more videos. I made videos for my students. Next thing you know, I'm making videos for Make Magazine. Then I moved to New York, and where I continued to work on making videos for Make Magazine, worked for Etsy for a bit, and then quit that to start MakerBot.
Etsy being the online marketplace for handmade items. I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bree Pettis, the co-founder of MakerBot. We'll hear more from Bree coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Bree Pettis, the co-founder of MakerBot Industries, a company that makes three-dimensional printers. So instead of producing ink on paper, the machine makes actual objects made out of plastic. Bree started the company in 2009 with his partners Zach Hokensmith and Adam Mayer. Prior to starting MakerBot, Bree was a public elementary school teacher in Seattle, Washington, a puppeteer, and an artist. He also is one of the founders of NYC Resistor, a hacker collective located in Brooklyn. You've been willing to expose yourself, your private life, to some extent, publicly, using the internet.
Sure.
And you've been blogging since 2004. And I'd love for you to read one of your blogs from 2004. It's entitled Dream. Okay.
Okay.
You're laughing. Why are you laughing?
You got me. Okay. So here we go. So I've been blogging for a long time. I actually had a blog in '99, but it was anonymous, and I ended up erasing it. It's this idea of sharing what you're thinking. Okay. And then I got at one point in 2004, I was like, okay, I'm just gonna share everything, including my dreams. So I just woke up from a dream that involved going to the transmission shop, driving to a farm owned by my brother, enjoying the farm, and then falling from a pulley cable slide. My brother was played by Tom Hanks, and when I fell, I began screaming incoherently, and I was paralyzed with a plastic sword in each hand. Even though I was screaming inside, I knew the tragedy because I would die and I would miss out on marrying the love of my life, and I would miss my brother, and all the things I want to do would never be done. Tom Hanks carried me through 3 feet deep of water, and I was still screaming in my dream as I woke up. My dream reflected a few things to me. First of all, I love my brother and I love having a brother. Secondly, I touched on a deep sadness in me. I've experienced loss and I can touch that sadness in myself. I've been having a lot of dreams lately. Feels like a time of change in my life. My modus operandi has been to go with the flow and accept the events and things that come to me in life and nurture those opportunities. I've changed a little now in that I am searching to build something. I'm searching for a path that I can set out on. No more hitchhiking through life. I want to drive my own train.
How do you feel reading that now?
You know, one of the nice things about having a blog is that you leave breadcrumbs for yourself to say, like, okay, this is where I'm at now. And so I can see then in 2004, I wanted to start making things happen more. I wanted to be like, okay, let's do things. You know, I think this is a little bit of a moment where you can see, like, okay, I wanted something, but I didn't know what. It took me a few years to get to a place where I'm quite happy with driving things.
You talk about being deeply sad. What made you deeply sad at that point in your life?
I don't know, actually. I'm not sure.
What is your feeling about, you know, sharing your personal life and?
So when I first started making videos, I was video blogger like number 13 in this early crew of video bloggers. And I was making videos for my students and I was making personal videos and I was sharing them. And we grew this community of like 25 or 30 people. And we were just making videos that were like, let me show you my apartment. And people weren't doing this at the time. So it felt like, okay, we're in this club of people who are sharing, you know, look at what my cat did today. And it sounds kind of silly to say today because YouTube is just absurdly full of this kind of stuff. But back then it really felt like we're breaking new ground. We're finding new ways to share. And sharing is really important to me. It's one of those things where, if you are not somebody who shares, you should be, because there's a future out there that is sadder if you don't. We're in a nice time where just in the past few years, sharing has become something that has value. You know, and even if you just share stories about how you dealt with something or how you got your baby to sleep at night or whatever, it means you're leaving breadcrumbs for other people so they won't feel as alone, so that when they go to learn how to do something, they can build on what you did and take it to the next level.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bree Pettis, the co-founder of MakerBot Industries, a company that makes three-dimensional printers that produce plastic objects. You moved to Brooklyn in 2007, and prior to starting MakerBot, you were one of the creators of NYC Resistor, which is a hacker collective, which allows people to tinker with software and technology. But the word hacker kind of has this negative connotation that, like, you're invading somebody else's technology. What was the purpose of this hacker collective in Brooklyn?
So NYC Resistor is a really special place. You enter it and there's a laser cutter, there's a big table where there's lots of people working on their laptops, there's soldering irons where people are assembling electronics, and there's, you know, all sorts of tools and materials. A member of NYC Resistor can make anything. Our motto is, we learn, share, and make things. When people think about a hacker, a lot of times they think about, like, oh, somebody's breaking into my computer. But I believe a hacker is somebody who's got a special enthusiasm for figuring out how things work and using them in special ways. An example of somebody who, when we first started, we came out, our first model 3D printer was the Cupcake. It was inexpensive, it worked, and it was great. But it was our first machine, so there was a lot of room for improvement. Because we shared all the designs, people could hack on it. They could improve it. And they did. They built all these crazy adaptations. They took the Z stage, which is the part that goes up and down. They ripped the back off it. They put their own one on. And they could do that because they could print out replacement parts that improved the machine. Mm-hmm. And every time this happened, we celebrated it. We were like, cool. This person found a way of taking what we did and improving on it, mm-hmm, and sharing back with the community.
You met Zach Hokensmith and Adam Mayer, your co-founders of MakerBot, at NYC Resistor, and you decided you wanted to make a go of this as a company, and you raised $75,000 from friends and family initially, and that $75,000 turned into $5 million of revenue. Were you surprised by the level of demand for this?
Yeah, I mean, we started it off and we were like, okay, this, when we started, we kind of fooled ourselves thinking, yeah, we'll just start this. This will be something we do. Maybe we'll do other stuff too. And then as soon as we sold the first 20 in no time flat, we were like, okay, now we got to make more. Mm-hmm. And so we spent that first 3 months prototyping and getting ready, and then we launched our product. Then we spent the next like 9 or 10 months just figuring out how to pack and ship and put labels on things and count out nuts and bolts and stuff like this.
How were you supporting yourself at the time financially?
Oh, we were broke. We weren't paying ourselves. Every time we got, you know, money, we were spending it on robot parts. I skipped rent 1 month just because I didn't have it. We're a committed group. We were really into it.
To what extent did being broke scare you?
Well, being broke sucks. It means you can't take your girlfriend out to dinner, and it's pretty stressful. To counter that, we knew we were onto something, and we had to ride. We had to ride it as hard as we could and push it as hard as we could so we can get as many of them out there and change the world.
You talk about being broke while you were trying to get the company off the ground, and it was hard to not be able to take your girlfriend out to dinner. Your girlfriend at the time became your eventual partner and the mother of your child. How did you meet Keo Stark?
We met playing Werewolf, which is a game where you try and use deceit and lying to survive in a town of werewolves. And this is a real life game. It's not online. And together you are a village, and you have to figure out, and there's werewolves in the village, and you have to figure out who they are, except you don't know who they are because they look like people. So you have to figure out who's lying.
Was either of you a werewolf?
Absolutely not. We were both villagers. I met Keo and we were talking about trying to effectively lie, trying to come up with strategies for that, and Keo's a horrible liar. And so that was a nice way to kind of start with an honest moment about deception, I guess.
Is there a community of werewolf players out there somewhere?
Werewolf is one of those games that's gotten popular on like conferences. Mm-hmm. So after the conference, you'll get like 10 or 12, 15 people together and a bunch of drinks, and you'll sit around and lie to each other, see if you can figure out who's lying.
Keo is an author, and she recently wrote a novel called Follow Me Down. She's also written a manual, a handbook called Don't Go Back to School.
Keo did a lot of interviews with people to figure out how they learned things without going to school. Mm-hmm. So it's all about how to learn things without having to pay for it.
You've created with Keo a manifesto of sorts called The Cult of Done. How do you live your life, or how do you express this cult of done?
There's some things like, you know, if you have an idea and you don't execute it within a week, throw it away. Don't do it. Mm-hmm. Abandon it. Then there's things like done is the engine of more. So when you finish something, it means you can do more. So finish more things so you can start more things. Another one is like everything is a rough draft. Don't strive for perfection. Just get it to a place where you're satisfied.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bree Pettis, the co-founder of MakerBot Industries, a company that makes open source robots that make plastic objects. MakerBot's 3D printers produce objects used for designing, recreation, and practical life. So things like bathtub plugs, shower curtain rings, bottle openers. A MakerBot printer costs roughly $1,300. I want to talk some more about the varied applications of some of the objects that MakerBot produces.
Sure.
For instance, somebody made an engagement ring out of a MakerBot machine. What's that story?
So there's a guy named Finnflood, and he was going to Iceland the next day with his sweetie. And he thought, you know, it's Friday night, and he thought, maybe this would be a great time. This would be a beautiful place. Maybe I'll find a beautiful place to go and pop the question. But I need a ring, and it's late, and I'm leaving tomorrow. So he popped down to his local hackerspace and printed one out, and they went to Iceland, and he gave it to her, and she said yes. And it's a really nice story because it means, like, you can have a MakerBot and print out anything, really.
That's one small example, but do you have, like, a larger mission or hope for the company? I mean, here's somebody who makes, you know, an engagement ring, but What does this look like on a larger scale? Or it might just be like you just want people to make stuff.
Well, when we started, we saw those first 20 machines and we thought, okay, here's potential energy. This is going out there and people are going to use these machines to make anything they want. And now that we've got, goodness, 7,000 machines are out in the wild right now, 7,000 MakerBots, we're seeing what people are doing. Every day there's new things that people are making. You know, they're making cookie cutters, they're making robots, they're making characters, they're making remote control cars. The thing that's getting me excited these days is what will we do together? What can 7,000 MakerBots in the world do? One of the projects we're working on right now is called Project Shelter. We're making shells for hermit crabs because hermit crabs are facing a housing shortage. So we're helping them.
What's wrong with the shells of hermit crabs now?
Hermit crabs don't make their own shells. And humans take them away from the beach, and the snails that make the shells that hermit crabs like are not producing as many shells. So they're doing things like sticking their butts in bottles and sticking their butts in shotgun shells and stuff like this, and that's just wrong. People have uploaded different designs for shells because hermit crabs are kind of picky, and it works. The community collectively are solving an ecological problem.
What are other examples?
When Deepwater Horizon, the catastrophe that happened in the Gulf where they were drilling and oil was just flooding into the Gulf, the Thingiverse community rallied together to try and figure out, okay, what's the problem? How can we help? I'm really curious as the community grows to see what will, not just what will one printer do, but what will 7,000 printers and their users do to change the world together.
What is the Thingiverse?
Thingiverse is a universe of things. It's a place to share your digital designs. So you can, if you design something, say you design a new type of bottle opener, you can upload it and share it and everybody can benefit.
Another project that you've worked on in the past is an art project where you exhibited works of art made by MakerBot at the New Museum in New York City. Talk to me about that project.
Yes.
This was a project that you did with Zach Lieberman.
Yeah. So Zach Lieberman and I went to Tompkins Square Park and we took strangers and we set them down and we asked them to tell them who are the important people in your life. Immediately it got good when people talk to you about who they care about and share the people who are important to them. They get emotional. And we caught that on video and we caught that with a 3D scanner. And then we printed out miniature heads about 4 inches tall of the people who had done this. And then we projected images of them talking on it. So in some ways, it was kind of like, you know that moment in Star Wars where Princess Leia goes, "Help me, Obi-Wan, you're my only hope." And she's in 3D and she's projected. It was kind of like that.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Bree Pettis, co-founder of MakerBot Industries, a company that makes 3D printers. Speaking of the important people in your life, you became a father in 2011, and in the spirit of sharing your life on the internet, you talked about the hardship that you faced when your daughter was born prematurely, and she was in the NICU for a couple of months. You blogged or wrote about one particular incident when she was in the NICU and no one was paying attention.
Yeah.
Can you describe that experience briefly?
So hospitals suck. The internet hasn't arrived to hospitals. And the way that data gets transferred at hospitals is people work 12 hours because they're two 12-hour shifts. And then they stay a little bit longer than their 12 hours because the next person comes on shift. And they share everything that they've done in the last 12 hours the most with the next person. And that's the way that data transfer happens in a hospital. So I had a baby named Nika, and she was born 7 weeks early, which is really early, and she was 2.5 pounds. So she had to go to the NICU, which is where they put babies in little boxes and watch them. And the second night I came back, because they don't let you be there from, I think it's 8 to 9, because that's their transition time where they're expected to share the data. And I arrived at 9, and the monitors were flatlined, which means there's no heartbeat, no breathing, no oxygen. And I was like, okay, before I completely freak out, I'm just going to check. And so I went over and I checked her pulse and I checked her breathing, and she was breathing and there was a pulse. And I started looking at, and I looked at the monitor, and it was clear it hadn't been hooked up for 2 hours. Hmm. And so I asked the nurse, I said, you know, this is why my baby hasn't been hooked up for 2 hours. And rather than saying, oh, I'm sorry, let me fix this right now, this is horrible, she proceeded to make excuses about how overworked they were, how the technology isn't reliable, how the backup systems hadn't been in effect, and how hard it was to find good people.
Making excuses.
Making lots of excuses. And if she had just said, I'm going to fix this right now, would have been fine. But making excuses meant that these, you know, four layers of redundancy had all failed, and I was the only one who'd noticed it. And I'm sure parents who are listening can imagine, you know, when you're trust your baby to someone else and they don't let you be there. I was just, I got really mad.
Anything that a MakerBot could fix?
You know what, though? When I was in the NICU, I was there for 6 weeks and I basically camped out there. And I, you know, I looked at all the technology there. The isolette, which is the box that the baby's in, that also has a, you know, that also has a bunch of hookups and stuff like this for it, and has air that you can pump in. You know, that costs like a lot of money, like $75,000 for that box. And I'm thinking, okay, I could do that for three and maintain all the functionality.
3,000.
Yeah. What I did in my 6 weeks of the NICU was just sit there and reverse engineer all the stuff in the hospital, thinking, oh my gosh, I can't believe they pay this much for it.
Hmm. Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here.
My guest has been Bree Pettis, the co-founder of MakerBot. Coming up, we'll meet Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Read. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Read, an organization that promotes literacy in India. Planet Read adds subtitling to songs on TV programs in the same language as the audio, so people can read the words as they are sung. Same language subtitling, or SLS, first appeared in 1999 in the Indian state of Gujarat on a 30-minute program of film songs, and now the service is available to 300 million viewers on a weekly basis. Welcome.
Thank you.
I'd like to start off with your personal history. You grew up in a town on the southern eastern coast of India called Pondicherry. There's an ashram in the center of the town. What role did the ashram play in your life?
Typically, when you think of an ashram in India, you think of people meditating, doing yoga, on a totally spiritual journey. But the Aurobindo Ashram is also very unusual in the sense that actually it emphasizes a lot of sports. So physical education is very important. The other interesting thing about the Aurobindo Ashram was that there are no exams in the schools. So I went from kindergarten till college in one sweep without ever having taken a single exam.
How is your knowledge tested without an exam?
So the system there is that the classes are extremely small. So you might have about 5 to 10 students typically in a classroom. And the teacher is able to really look at the progress of each individual student quite personally.
So after graduating from the ashram, you go to the Indian Institute of Technology to get a master's in physics. Do you remember taking your first test?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I have to admit that for the first semester, it was really a struggle for me, switching from never having taken an exam to probably the other extreme of competition in India. In fact, the whole first semester was very difficult.
And then you find yourself in Ithaca, New York, of all places. You left India and went to Cornell to study communications. Do you remember your first impressions of the United States?
I do. I remember just being chaperoned by my fellow student, and he took me sort of around campus, showing things around. Everything was fascinating. But what really caught my attention was that he took me down to the basement of his chemistry department and showed me this box and a machine. And he took out some coins, put it in this machine, and then pressed a button, and down came a can of Coke. And I remember that was so fascinating to me that actually you could get a can of Coke just by, I mean, not even talking to a person.
And do you remember the feeling of cold in Ithaca? I mean, you grew up in Pondicherry where it's like 100 degrees Fahrenheit. What was it like to feel Ithaca winters?
I remember the first time I saw snow. In fact, I was 23 years old and it snowed and we were all in a classroom. And all of the Indian students left the room, literally, and the professor was wondering what's going on. Mm. And then I also remember when it was really cold, actually, I had already started to sport a beard. So my breath would actually freeze on the beard, and it was like icicles on the beard. So I remember that as well.
My guest is Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Read, an organization that promotes literacy in India through service called Same Language Subtitling, or SLS. By adding words to the bottom of a TV screen in the same language as the audio, adults and children can practice their reading skills. Bridge, the first time you began to focus on literary issues was, ironically, not in India, but in Ecuador while you were a student at Cornell. How did you first come into contact with those literacy issues in Ecuador?
The project that I did in Ecuador was to actually document the knowledge of medicinal plants of 7 indigenous communities there in the Andes. The issue that we were really concerned was that people were losing their knowledge. The issue of literacy came to the fore then because we realized that even after documenting the knowledge in a written form, it was still not accessible to most people in those communities. So we decided that we would actually represent that written text of the book that we ended up publishing in an iconic form. So every plant remedy and how it was actually used was represented visually. Mm-hmm. And when we did that, we found out that even children were able to make, you know, sense of what we had put down visually on the in print.
Incidentally, you were trying to prevent the disappearance of this knowledge of medicinal plants. Was there any resonance for you because you had studied Ayurvedic medicine at all when you were in India?
Yes, my family in particular is extremely oriented towards Ayurveda and natural remedies. My dad actually eats aloe vera, and he's convinced me to eat aloe vera. And so there are so many things that I just grew up doing at home that were mostly, you know, in the generally the naturopathic realm. So that definitely had an influence. But I think what really influenced me to take this conservation of knowledge issue in Ecuador was really the politics of knowledge, because a lot of knowledge is actually extracted from indigenous communities, and that ends up being somewhere else, and some other people benefit from it. So our goal was that how can we conserve the knowledge for the people and with the people?
And then how did this interest in knowledge and literacy translate to this idea for same language subtitling, or SLS?
So I spent about 2 years in Ecuador doing this conservation of knowledge, and then I went back to Ithaca to write my dissertation. And typically what you do when you write your dissertation is actually you watch movies to just, you know, procrastinate, really. And so we were 5 or 6 of us just sitting in a room watching Spanish films, and this one in particular happened to be Pedro Almodovar's The Women on the Verge of a Nervous Breakdown, hilarious movie. And we were watching this film, and it was in the subtitles were in English, so the audio was in Spanish. And at that, I just made a casual comment that why don't they just put Spanish subtitles on a Spanish film, and that way we would be able to learn Spanish more. And that was our goal at that moment. And actually, if they just put Hindi subtitles on Bollywood film songs, maybe India would become literate. And it was more like a casual comment. I said, well, let me try it out as a research project. And that's how the whole thing started.
It's ironic that you had to be in Ecuador in order to come up with this idea. I guess you're feeling illiterate and you're feeling the need to learn Spanish caused the issue to become more personal in a way.
Right. I totally agree with that. Actually, my interest in learning Spanish had become very, very strong. In fact, to a point where I was a little bit insane, perhaps, to actually label everything at home in Spanish. So everybody, my roommates, were like a little irritated that whenever they picked up a knife, it said cuchillo on it. So,
by the way, you grew up in a very literate, well-educated family, but in India, 35% of the population is considered illiterate. So what was your exposure to illiteracy in India when you were growing up?
My mom actually became literate much later in life as an adult. And so I could see shades of literacy even within my family. My dad was totally literate. My mom was semi-literate. Illiteracy was all around us in a way. So there was always this sense that illiteracy is a major issue in India.
And when we say the literacy rate is, we should translate to 65%, how is literacy measured? Is that 65% accurate?
It's not a very accurate measure. What typically they do is a census operator actually shows up to a home in a village and would ask a family to list down all the names and then mark each person on whether they're literate or not based on what one individual in the household actually says. So you end up with people who have, let's say, learned a little bit of the alphabet or learned to basically draw their name, not even write their name, just draw their name. They will call themselves literate. Half the people who are thought of as literate by the census are actually what I would call semi-literate.
My guest is Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Read, an organization that promotes literacy in India through a service called Same Language Subtitling, or SLS. By adding words to the bottom of a TV screen in the same language as the audio, adults and children can practice their reading skills. So you came back to India in 1996, where you pursue this SLS idea further, this same language subtitling idea further. How did you get it off the ground initially?
What we would do is, take some, tapes of Bollywood film songs and show them at bus stops, in railway stations, in villages, slums. And what we would do is we'd just plop two televisions, one playing the songs without the subtitles and one playing with the same language subtitles. And we'd ask people to just compare the two and see which one they liked. Almost everybody, over, I would say, 90% or 95% of the people we interviewed, actually said that they preferred the songs with the subtitles. So what's happening is that people are getting their reading skills practiced as the words get highlighted, and they really don't know that very consciously. They're not aware of it.
Now, you talk about Bollywood films. For those of us in New York or Washington, D.C. or Texas, we might not have had exposure to Bollywood films. What is a Bollywood film?
Oh, if you haven't seen one, please make it a life ambition to see one. I'm a really passionate Bollywood fan myself. Typically, a Bollywood film will have six songs on average, which would mean that they're really musicals. So it's an industry that has just captivated a large section of the world, I would say, not just in India.
Now, when you talk about just plopping these TVs down in railway stations or bus stops, that seems a little strange to me. I think of Grand Central Station in New York. If you just plop a TV down in the middle of the lobby, people would just run away from it, probably. What is the mindset? Are there people just hanging out around the railway stations just watching this stuff?
I think India, in any place, you could actually create a theater and there would be people just congregating there. Any small incident will get a crowd. And we'd get easily 100 to 200 people just gather around the television set. So there was just that, people have a lot of time on their hands too. And they're waiting for a train or they're getting off a train. It's not like they have to, rush off to some meeting or work. Pace of life is quite slow for most people.
So you have this casual focus group among these people in the railway stations and the bus stops and the villages. How do you then get it on TV? Your first SLS program was on Gujarat State TV, which is Gujarat is one of the states in India. How did that happen?
So after we were convinced that people in the villages liked this idea, we actually did a proper controlled experiment in a low-income school. And we found that the children in grades 3, 4, and 5 who were exposed to the subtitles, their reading improvement was much faster than the group that was not exposed to the songs with the subtitles. Now, based on that study, we thought, now we have the proof. And when we engaged the director at that point of the television station then, he flatly refused. And his hunch was that this, when you add the subtitles to a song-based program, it'll ruin the program. And so it really became his gut feeling versus our data.
How did you get over that?
What we did is we wrote to all the station directors around the country and asked them if they would try this out on any program. And we would pay for the subtitling, but would they just be willing to allow us to try this out? And nobody responded, except one person who happened to be the director of the All India Radio in Gujarat. And unfortunately, he was not the director of the television station. But 3 months later, this guy who wrote back actually ended up becoming the director of the television station in Gujarat State, a total stroke of luck. And he basically said, try this out on television for 3 episodes only. And if the response is good, we'll see. He got calls from a lot of people saying that, wow, you guys are doing wonderful work for literacy.
My guest is Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Read, an organization that promotes literacy in India through a karaoke-like service called Same Language Subtitling, or SLS. How did you fund the project throughout this time?
So we've tapped into a lot of various sources, and we've kind of had a lot of patchwork funding. But then we really got a big break in 2002. We applied to Development Marketplace. It's a global innovation competition at the World Bank with this idea. And we basically asked for the maximum that they would give, which was about $250,000. And to our surprise, actually, we got it. And that really gave us the huge break that we needed to then try and approach national television in Delhi. Of course, even after that, we faced other kinds of hurdles. And I mean, this project has been going on for 11 years now, and there have been so many hurdles. So for example, there was this ridiculous hurdle, I would say, where one of the directors in the national television program wanted actually our equipment, which was about $50,000, $60,000 of editing equipment. He wanted that in exchange for allowing us to subtitle, even though they were not paying for the equipment. But even then, we told those guys that, okay, you can have the equipment, provided you promise that you're going to continue subtitling on a national television program for 5 years. And they couldn't accept that.
Wow, so you almost succumbed to his ridiculous request.
Yeah, actually, it was a kind of an, I would say, a pretty thought-through succumbing, if I can call it that. Because what we knew was the life of the equipment is really about 5 years.
In addition to other challenges you faced, you were having difficulty getting FaceTime with the CEO of TV in India, which is kind of analogous to, I guess, the head of the FCC in the United States. How did you get his attention ultimately?
Getting to this person was not easy. So I sent in word that I really wanted to meet him, and he sort of said that he might be able to see me, but wasn't really sure. So I waited about 5-6 hours, literally outside, as I saw, one executive after another just walk by me. And I couldn't get any time with him. But he kind of knew that I was waiting. So finally, he sent word that if I wouldn't mind just taking a ride with him in his car as he went from the television station to his hotel, that was about a 10-minute ride. So I said, great, And then I got into the car with him. I already had my laptop running a Bollywood film song, just turned up the volume and showed it to him. And you won't believe it. He just looked at the idea for literally 15 seconds, didn't say a word, and then said, okay, you come and see me in Delhi, because I think we could actually do something with this. And he became one of the strongest supporters of this idea.
Do you worry that there might be some pushback that maybe consumers or viewers want the choice to have these words on the bottom of their screen?
What we did in India is actually did like 3-4 surveys to first find out whether even the literate people actually like this idea or not. And what we found is that the popularity among the literate was over 90%. It was just the entertainment and the karaoke effect of subtitling. On the semi-literate, it was both entertainment and reading practice that they valued. And the illiterates also valued, and their support was about 70%. So people were willing to support it pretty much all across.
Now, Bridge, you live in the San Francisco area in Oakland, yet this project is India-based. How do you split your time?
I pretty much spend half the year in India and half the year in the Bay Area in Oakland. What I focus on is policy pushing in India and also fundraising and relationship building in the United States.
How many children do you have?
I have three children, two boys and a girl.
What languages do they speak?
Our children are growing up speaking Hindi, English, of course, and then Portuguese.
Why Portuguese?
So my wife speaks Portuguese and I speak Spanish. And I wanted Spanish, she wanted Portuguese, she won, of course.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Bridge Kothari, founder of Planet Read. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.com or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. Our website is FromScratchRadio.org. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.